know what you're saying. In other words, this should be fairly easy to put together with laminate, you know, laminating strips, this type of dielectric antenna. It doesn't sound like it would be a big project to make these things, and yet you hear real little or nothing about it. How about the bandwidth on such an antenna? If you've had experience with this type of antenna, I've never seen this actually on an amateur radio market. First, what about bandwidth? Does it suffer, or does it give a good bandwidth, say a 10 gig dick over?
It's going to have considerably more bandwidth than a Yagi of the same gain and of the same approximate physical size. More bandwidth. Because in the case of a Yagi where you're making a dielectric equivalent by way of the director string, all of those directors on a long Yagi really constitute a synthesized dielectric material. It's got a certain velocity factor, just like plastic has. I mean, the polyethylene in our coax cable has a kind of velocity factor of 69. If you've got a big enough chunk of polyethylene, you can beautifully make a dial guide antenna out of it. And you got the right idea. By laminating chunks of plastic with the right kind of air spaces between them, and fine enough gradation of the plastic, probably the plastic in the half-inch pieces, so to speak, with the right amount of air space between them, or different kinds of plastic, you can synthesize whatever velocity factor you want for the beginning, the middle, and the end of the antenna. Quite often you want to taper the velocity factor. That's why you taper the elements on long Yagis. I'm oversimplifying here, but the techniques by which you model a long Yagi and the techniques by which you model a dial guide have a lot of similarity. No one has done it. I agree with you. I haven't seen one single amateur radio offered product called dial guide for the microwave ham radio operators. We're way past the point where that antenna has a lot to offer, and we should certainly consider it. It's not going to give you a breakthrough compared to a Simone antenna, a so-called cigar antenna, the one that's got all the washers. It's capable of similar gain, but the dial guide is capable of a lot more bandwidth. The reason for that is that when I make a synthesized dielectric material out of washers or dipoles, in the case of the director string of a Yagi, as I make minor changes to the frequency, those individual directors go above and below resonance real fast. Therefore, their velocity factor changes real fast. In the case of plastic, when I go higher and lower in frequency, the velocity factor stays the same. Therefore, the dial guide is capable of a hell of a lot more bandwidth than any Yagi that you and I have ever built. Over to you, Mel. I can tell you're getting ideas.
You know, this is KQKY. You know, I'm just saying, this makes so much sense. And I've never really heard much about this, you know, maybe in passing. But if I made this thing up, this laminated thing, and I shoved it into the waveguide, how many dBs can I, you know, get additional out of that waveguide, Dick? It sounds like a natural gadget, you know, simple thing to just plug in and make like a, you know, make it up so that it would easily, like, snap into the end of a waveguide, Dick, over.
Once the design is perfected, duplicating it is easy, and making a whole lot of them for the whole club, easy. The design itself is not that easy. And by the way, you don't have to put the dial guide very far into the guide. And usually the portion that goes into the guide is tapered, so you don't have a great big standing wave ratio bump. You want to slowly taper into the plastic. So there's going to be a tapered section that goes into the guide. And then the plastic itself that's on the outside, the dial guide, has to have the right dimensions, the right dielectric constant, the right dimensions in width, height, and length, and the right dielectric constant in the various areas. I didn't say the design is easy, but it isn't too different if you were modeling a Yagi, a long Yagi, and if you're modeling a dial guide. The techniques for modeling have a strong similarity. The principle of operation is almost identical, even though it looks so different to the eye. So the design itself, it's going to take some research. I didn't say it's something you're going to whip up tonight, but once you perfect the design, duplicating it, and changing the materials and duplicating it again, oh, you can have a grand old time with this one, Mel. KQKEY, the new antenna factory of Brooklyn, of Manhattan Beach, KQRIW.
KC2QIQ with a question.
KC2QIQ, go ahead with your question.
Yeah, it's actually for Dick about the about one of these dielectric antennas. With a waveguide, it's 10 gigahertz. If you were to place one of these at the end of a waveguide, would that give you enough gain where you wouldn't actually require a dish for operation?
Yes. I guess it's Glenn that we're talking to. And in the case of a 2-foot diameter dish, which I'm using on 10 gigs before it blew down a couple of years ago, and I got to put it back up again. The 2-foot dish on 10 gigs, I seem to remember it gave me something like 35 dB of gain. A dial guide antenna could easily give you 10 or 15 dB of gain. It can give you the gain of a good size feed horn. And you could use it as a feed horn if you wanted to. Could you get 35 dB of gain out of it? That's pushing it. With current design knowledge. Now, the fact that Dave O'Lean of Directive Systems, K1WHS, has built a 102-element Yagi, and I think he's getting something like 22 dB of gain out of it. Could you get 22 dB of gain out of a dial guide? Absolutely. Could you get 35 dB of gain? I'm a little bit skeptical. When the waveguide is 9/10 of an inch wide, and you're building a dial guide in front of it, a chunk of plastic material, that's not going to be too much wider in places than 9/10 of an inch. And it's going to be a foot or two long. Can it act like a 2-foot diameter dish? That's pushing. You're not going to get that much gain, Glenn. However, in bang per dollar, and when it comes to wind load compared to that dish, and as long as you only want, let me say, 10, 15, or 20 dB of gain, then I think that antenna has a lot to offer. Back to you, Glenn.
Oh, thanks, Dick. That's very interesting. I guess that raises my second question, which is, if you put a dial guide on the end of a waveguide, and you have a very high gain now pointed at a dish, does that cause a problem? And or is there any special distances, or, you know, does that be a certain wavelength away from the dish when you add that much gain?
Yeah, I know where you're going with this one. It turns out for every dish, you can calculate a certain focal length to diameter ratio. Once you do that, what you're really calculating is, from the feed horn's point of view, how many degrees in azimuth and elevation does the antenna, the dish parabolic reflector, subtend? The proper design of a feed horn is such that it should have enough beam width in azimuth and elevation to properly illuminate your dish. If you use a feed horn that's got too much gain, that's a fancy way of saying it's got too narrow a beam width, that means it's going to create a hot spot in the middle of your parabolic reflector, and you're not going to be putting any energy on the perimeter of the parabolic reflector. You could cut away that perimeter and nothing would happen. So, as you can tell, for every parabolic dish in F over D, not size, the common sense would lead you to believe if you've got a big dish, you should use a big horn. If you've got a small dish, you should use a small horn. It's the focal length to diameter ratio, the depth of the dish. Is it a flat dish or a deep dish? Therefore, from the feed horn's point of view, does it subtend a big angle or a small angle? If it subtends a big angle, you want a low-gain feed horn. If it subtends a small angle, because it's a very flat dish and a very long focal length, then you want a very high-gain horn. There is an ideal gain of the feed horn for every dish F over D. However, the number of wavelengths that the dish, the parabolic reflector, is in front of the horn almost doesn't matter. That's not quite true. There's some secondary effects you have to worry about. But for the most part, you don't have to worry about that. Now, if you design an extremely flat dish with a very large F over D ratio, such that it needed a very high gain feed horn, and as a very high gain feed horn, you use a dial guide, and now the tip of the dial guide almost touched the parabolic reflector, would that work? The answer is yes. There is a military dish that uses that characteristic. The dial guide is the support for the so-called feed horn. I think you can see where we're going here, Glenn. It can be made to work. Over to you, Glenn.
Thanks, Dick. Very informative, because, you know, the 10 gigahertz dish is, I think I had a discussion with you a few months back, and I was looking at, you know, building a few things over here, and it's still mostly in the drawing end for yet. I haven't quite gotten to the hardware part of the dish and, you know, the feed horn part, because a lot of questions I still have, but thanks. Now you just give me something else to look into now for a while, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, make sure you visit the W1 Gigahertz website, Whiskey One Golf Hotel Zulu. He's got an online developing book on 10 gigahertz and microwave techniques and how to properly design feed horns and the right patterns and focal length to diameter ratio and what does the feed horn look like when it's laid out on a flat sheet of metal before you bend it up. I wonder, have you discovered the W1 Gigahertz website yet? Glenn, go ahead.
No, I haven't, Dick. As a matter of fact, I was just going to ask you for that really quick. I just grabbed a pencil. That's W1GHZ. Is that like a .com?
You got it. I think it's not .com. It may be .org. If you Google W1 gigahertz, you'll find it pretty fast. If you don't, if you also just go to Tom Williams, WA1MBA, Whiskey Alpha 1, Mike Bravo Alpha, .org, you go to that website, and of his many references, you'll find the W1 gigahertz website. You find Paul Wade at W1 gigahertz. You find his online book. It is a wealth of information. He and I lock horns occasionally because he's got a couple of very minor errors here and there. You know, second decimal place type stuff. And some of his concepts are a little bit tilted compared to the way I think Mother Nature works. But 99% of what he's got there is extremely good stuff. Go for it. And if you have any trouble finding it, let me know. Mel, back to you. And I think that Dover Street is about to have a new kind of antenna becoming popular. KQKEY, KQRIW.
Dick, I have a website for you, WS2N.
Go ahead, Paul.
It'll take a minute, though. I don't know if you want to continue on it. It's too big of a URL. I'll just show you how to get there real quick from Google.
Okay, tell us what words you use as the search engine in Google, and therefore we can find it. Go right ahead, Paul.
You put in Diagram International Space Station. You put that in. And then, but before you do it, click on images first. You know, you go to Google, you click on images, and then you put in Diagram International Space Station. You're going to get, 1 to 20 choices. You go to GeoCities. They call it GeoCities. It's the third choice to the right and the second one down. It's the one that's all in color. It's some exploded view. Dick, can you find that?
Beautiful. That's a good guide. And isn't there a website that will allow you to fly through the International Space Station? In other words, you dial up the right website, and you can literally navigate yourself down the hall, so to speak. Paul, I wonder if you've seen that one. Go ahead.
I know NASA has it. I don't have broadband here. This is all dial-up, Dick. I'm in the dark ages. The best view of this whole thing I have is 2 years old, and it came from the Newsday. I don't know. There used to be a way to get into the Newsday sites. I'm not really that good with searching things on the computer, but Newsday had a... They call it the fold in the Newsday. I have a big paper here. You know, it was the Wednesday, December 6th, 2006, page 38. And I guess if you could find a way to get into the Newsday site where you could download that, they have a very good exploded view. And with, and a picture of it next to it, what they were building at the time when that space shuttle went up there. But if you go to this one with GeoCities, you click on that. You might want to save that on your computer. And you can tell by looking at it, the present configuration is there, but also the future configuration of what they propose. A lot of things have been canceled on that website. But, you can see what the things that I marked off are on the net earlier, you could see that are listed on there. It's interesting. They have different colors, like yellow is the Russians, and the blue is the Canadians. and they're showing the one of the craft, the Zarya, as a yellow one. But it was actually that. You see, when this thing was made up, it was actually built by the Russians. Here it looks like it was supposed to be done by the Americans. So it's an older design. A few things have been canceled off of this, but this gives you a pretty good overall view of what's on the space station now, and then and what they're going to be doing in the future. For instance, the module that's attached for spacewalk, they show that there, but they don't have the name. It's the Quest. They had this printed up before they named it the Quest module. So things like that are. It gives you an overall view, Dick. There might be better sites. I'll have to continue to look, but this is pretty good. Back to you, Dick.
Thank you, Paul. Sounds like you found a good one. And I'll be looking that one up in a little while. Glenn, good luck with your 10 gig work. Let me think now. I'm trying to remember where you live. Oh, yes. Massapequa. You're in my backyard. I've talked to people in, can't think of Larry Lippitt's call letters or town right now. He's in Nassau. Talked to him many times on 10 gig. There was a very active group of guys called themselves the 10X group. You know what 9X used to mean. And so we were an experimental group on 10 gigahertz. We called ourselves 10X. N2LIV is the president. K2RIW was acting as the technical guru, he thought. And we had about 10 guys in the Long Island area, with one or two of them in New Jersey and Connecticut. And we were all on 10 gigs talking to each other and whatever. That was a few years ago. My antenna blew down, needs repair as of a few years ago. Bruce, for whatever reason, N2LIV, became a little bit inactive. We both were dreaming about getting back on 10 gigs because it was the most fun we've ever had in ham radio. And we're going to certainly keep you in mind, along with Steve. I'm having trouble thinking of Steve's call letters now. He's also building up equipment. 10 gig operation on ham radio is kind of peculiar. That is, if there isn't at least one active spark plug keeping everybody interested, sharing equipment, doing measurements, having meetings, getting on the air and whatever, if you don't have at least one spark plug in, let's say, the Long Island area, then the activity drastically decreases. So Bruce or I or both of us have to get back on to build the activity back up again. It is the frontier, so hang in there, Glenn. Glenn, back to you for any other comments. Mr. QIV, K2RIW. I'm terrible on call letters right now. QIW, K2RIW.
Yeah, no, thanks, Dick. I've actually made some pretty good progress. I was using my FT847 for the transceiver, and then as far as the transducer actually that I'm using to go from 144 to 10 gig, the transverter, that's actually worked out pretty well. Then I kind of like started looking at feed lines going from that point, or mounting that very close to the dish assembly. That's kind of where I'm having a lot of trouble. I don't have a tremendous amount of test equipment above 1 gigahertz. So I'm trying to come up with looking on Google or some, you know, or eBay or something to try to come up with equipment, at least a good spectrum analyzer where I could sweep up to around 22 gigahertz. And I could probably do a lot of things with that, because right now, as far as things like field strength, I'm doing a lot of things blind. The calculations I can do, but the experiments are getting tough in that area.
In the old days, spectrum analyzers didn't go up to 10 gigs, and people put a mixer front end on the front end of the spectrum analyzer to make it work up there, a harmonic mixer. You already own a 10 gig transverter. That's the equivalent of that mixer. So if you're smart enough, it supplies the signal for transmitting. And yes, it would be nice to have a second transverter so you could simultaneously do some receiving. But there are various techniques with diode detectors by which you could measure standing wave ratio at 10 gigs out of your 10 gig transverter in the transmit mode. Yes, if this is the best of all worlds, it would be nice to have a spectrum analyzer that goes there. They tend to be expensive, unless you work for a factory that will loan you one or let you do it on off hours. It's not quite justified in price to buy one. If you're smart enough, the test equipment you've got would let you get by. When it comes to most of the antennas that people use on 10Gs, they are primarily optical-like. Parabolic reflectors or feed on, or the horn itself used as getting on the air. And by the way, many of the guys on 10Gs on Long Island got there with a mixer front end, a brick oscillator assembly that made 10.224 as a local oscillator, into a mixer, into a horn, and that was the transmitter and receiver. It converted down to 144 megs as an IF, and either an FM or an all-mode transceiver on the 144 meg connected to that mixer completed the rig. And you'd be amazed how much contact distance you can get out of that. It's got the same power as a gun flexor, and it's got 20 dB more sensitivity. So gun flexors have already been used for 1,200-mile CISOs. So you'd be amazed what you can do with what you've got. I'm hoping that Bruce and I in the near future will get back on 10 gigs, and we'll be blazing a trail between our QTHs and Massapequa and giving you some signal to listen to and to transmit from. A mixer front end would be all you would need to get on the air, if you know what I mean, when you have somebody else on the island with you. Now, if the nearest guy operative on 10 gigs is in Boston, until you've got a very good setup, you're in trouble. When Bruce from Wisconsin gets on the air and I from Huntington get on the air, Massapequa is an easy jump. So I'd like to believe sometime in the near future you'll have somebody to talk to. I know we're a little bit off subject, but if the guy on Dover Street was also on 10 gigs, talking to Brooklyn would be fun. I used to talk to my good buddy over in New Jersey, W2TTM, Ed O'Connor. I'm having trouble thinking the name of the town he's in. But he and I were, I think it was 50 miles apart. And we used to talk to QSO two or three times a week for a couple of years. And so that path, what was making that path so interesting is that directly midway between us, or maybe one-third of the way from him, two-thirds of the way from me, was the Coney Island parachute jump. And some of the weird anomalies we used to get in propagation, we used to speculate that some of the signals reflecting off the parachute jump. I know Ed and I have definitely intentionally reflected signals off of then the World Trade Center and also the Verrazano Bridge. But the World Trade Center, when he was in a particular location in New Jersey where the World Trade Center was directly north of him, and to me the World Trade Center is directly west, so our antennas were 90 degrees away from each other. We were reflecting signals off the World Trade Center, and there were times when the reflected signal off of World Trade was louder than we went directly to each other. So you'd be amazed what kind of building bounce mode you can do on 10 gigs. So it's a fun band. And these guys on Dover Street, they're going to get on 10 gigs. I'm hearing the sound. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Roger, this is K2KEY. I got the 10 gig antennas in the garage because lost interest and I couldn't drum up much interest in it some years ago, so it's in the garage there, so I know where it is up on the rack there amongst other antennas. Okay, very fascinating. So we got Yagis, we got Collinias, and now we got a new set of antennas. I know about, you know, the reflectors, both cylindrical and parabola and horns, and now we got a new antenna to add to the mix. Boy, it never ends. A dielectric rod antenna, Dick. That's something. That's very fascinating. A dielectric rod antenna to add to the mix. And I could see this could be a very interesting project, you know, to experiment with. Have a little spare time. Just because of the size and everything makes it very easy to work with. And it would be a fascinating, you know, to look into it. But this is something, like I say, I have never seen any commercial or military or any application of a dielectric rod antenna, Dick, over.
Thanks, W3WK. Hey, Eugene, we'll get to you in a second. Yeah, it's called dielectric rod antenna. It's called dial guide antenna. But dielectric rod is the most popular name. There is another name. When I get a chance, I'm going to open up my antenna engineering handbook to see if I can find the right chapter on the subject. Go ahead with your question or comment, Eugene.
Oh boy, I got my phone is being down, my phone number tonight. By the way, on the antenna on 1.2 gigahertz. I don't have a transmitter for that no longer. So what can I do with that? Nothing?
Okay, I think you're saying you've got a 1296 antenna or you've got a 1296 transverter, but not both, and you wondered what you can do. Well, you can always sell it on eBay if you're not using it, if you don't intend to get back on those bands. But there are people who will value your 1296 antenna or your 1296 transverter. Back to you, Eugene.
Okay, very good. I had a Kenwood on 1.2 gig. So now I don't have it no longer. Sold that. So I guess I'll have to save it till I get another radio on 1.2 gig. Okay, Dick, thank you very much, W2EWK.
Yeah, you might decide to go back on 1296, as I call it. 1296 is the narrow band section of the band, where people use single sideband and Morse code, and there's also a section nearby where people use FM and repeaters. And Limont, this particular group, did have and probably still has a 1280 megacycle, I think it is, repeater on that band. So it's got some interesting characteristics. When you were on 10 gigs, Mel, were you doing it by gunplexers, so-called broadband, wideband techniques, or were you doing it with a real crystal-controlled local oscillator and single sideband type tunable IF receiver, the so-called narrowband technique? The good news about the broadband technique is it's quick and cheap. Gunplexer and you're on the air, so to speak, with some extra electronics connected to it. The nice thing about the narrowband techniques is it's got about 20 decibels more sensitivity, and you can really hear what the carrier sounds like as it's reflected off of a cloud during rain, or off of a building, or off of an aircraft, or so on. Hearing the carrier itself and all of the funny characteristics it has, that in itself will really tickle your fancy. K2QIW. K2KEY.
Roger, this is K2KEY. Yeah, we're basically done with gunplexers at the time because a friend of mine was doing that work at the time for the telephone company. They were using it for, I guess, a number of places. I think most of his work was back out on the island. It was from building to building that they were using a microwave link, and they came up with a commercial variety of this and easily adaptable at that time to ham radio. In fact, for the installation, how they put them up, they put them on the roof of the telephone building, and they would just have the tripod, and it was weighted down with lead weights or something. Just sat there, and they ran a cable to it, and that was the whole system. It just aimed one at the other. I think that was a lot of the links years ago for the telephone system on the island, Dick, over.
A little bit more elaborate than that, but ham radio-wise, we are allowed to use all of 10.0 to 10.5 gigahertz, 500 megahertz of bandwidth. With the right kind of equipment, can you imagine the data rates you could send through that smell? At first, you'd say with 500 megs of bandwidth, you could send 500 million bits per second. Well, if you've got a high enough signal-to-noise ratio and you start using the compression techniques, 16 QAM, 64 QAM, you can now start transmitting data 5, 10, 15 times faster than the bandwidth would imply. So if you wanted to send gigahertz rate data on the 10 gig handband with modern day equipment, it would be almost easy. Back to you, Mel.
Hey, Roger, this is KTKEY. A fascinating subject, fascinating, you know, part of amateur radio, hardly touched, and I keep hearing, I gotta say, this thing really has attracted my attention. Never really thought of it. I don't even know if I ever heard of this dielectric antenna. So, okay, so we'll keep that in mind. A dielectric rod antenna, Dick. Okay, should we try one more before you leave?
Yeah, we've got 17 minutes or so, and it's not exactly a hard number, but I should leave at 11 because of my appointment tomorrow. Back to you, Mel.
Okay, no problem. This is K2KEY. Okay, let's read one more. And all. Like I say, it always fascinates me. Seems like always something new over the horizon. Let's see. I don't understand here. I read in the review of equipment, and they have one terminology such as 0.25. I think he means microvolt. Made a way he wrote it. That, yeah, 0.25 microvolt at 10 dBSN. Well, 10 dB. I think he means 10 dBS / N. Can you explain this terminology? What the heck I'm reading here? All right, you want to take a shot at it, and then I'll say a few words on it. I got one way of explaining it, but let you do it first, Dick. Go ahead.
Okay, I'll take a crack at it. Every receiver, whether it be single sideband, AM, FM, whatever, requires a certain amount of signal strength. Radio engineers usually measure that signal strength in microvolts. A millionth of a volt is a microvolt. So if you can put half a microvolt into your handy-talkie and get reasonably good reception, most likely your handy-talkie is working well. As that signal gets weaker and weaker, quarter of a microvolt, tenth of a microvolt, and so on, pretty soon the radio stops working. Well, it doesn't stop working immediately. The signal starts sounding noisy. So one of the definitions of the right amount of signal strength is a certain amount of signal-to-noise ratio. Most radios, when you give it a nice strong signal with the right kind of modulation, out of the loudspeaker you hear a nice clear signal and no other noise. On almost all radios, as the signal gets weaker and weaker, the amount of noise starts getting louder, and the voice that you want to listen to or the music you want to listen to starts getting weaker. So when you measure, let's call it music power to noise power, and there's ways you could do that by turning the music on and off and measuring how much noise is left over, you can eventually come up with something called signal to noise ratio, audio signal to noise ratio. And so in the old days, what used to be done to rate the quality of a FM receiver is how much signal strength in carrier was required for the noise output of the radio to go down by 20 decibels. You put no signal into the radio, you measure the amount of noise coming out of the loudspeaker. You start cranking up the signal generator until that noise power goes down by 20 dB. It used to be called 20 decibel quieting. And if that measured a quarter of a microvolt on most radios, that was pretty good. And as you go from a quarter of a microvolt on that particular radio to half and one, it gets quieter and quieter. You get 20 dB of quieting, 30 dB of quieting, 40 dB of quieting, and pretty soon there's nothing left except the hum of your power supply coming out of the loudspeaker, so to speak, which hopefully is 50, 60, 70 dB weaker. So signal-to-noise ratio coming out of the loudspeaker or earphones versus signal strength going in microvolts is a way of rating the quality of a receiver. There are other ways. 20 dB quieting is what I just described. 12 dB Steinman, signal to noise and distortion is another. Bit error rate, if you're sending digital data, is another. There's lots and lots of ways of measuring what you and I would call signal to noise at the loudspeaker, so to speak, versus signal strength going in. But once you accept the fact that every radio has that characteristic, to measure it is a very valuable piece of information. It tells you something about the quality factor of that radio, and in some cases it makes you decide, hey, I want to buy that one, and I don't want to buy this one. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. All right, just say a few words, basically what this gentleman Jan said to me. He says 0.25 microvolts, I believe that's what he meant, at 10 dBs / N. So basically what Dick just said is if we need to say put 0.25 microvolt signal into the receiver antenna in order to obtain an audio output signal F of about 10 times. That's the 10 dB. So the audio output power of the internally generated receiver noise, 10. So this would be exactly what it means. In other words, it means that in order to obtain at the 0.25 volt receiving antenna signal, we get an audio output signal, S, which is 10 times or 10 dB, then the audio output power of the internal generated noise, which is N. So that's how that ratio is, S slash N. It's the ratio of the signal to the noise rated at the 0.25 volt, microvolt, at 10 dB, or 10 times the audio output power. I think that's as simple as I can think of really to explain it, Dick, over.
Yeah, the first time you hear this, it sounds kind of complicated. After you've made a couple of measurements, if you happen to be in a laboratory with a medium good synthesized signal generator, that means the signal generator is not drifting in frequency, and a good laboratory signal generator, something like an IFR, which is a system monitor, or is that what it's called, or it's got another name? Can't think of. IFR is called a, what's the technical name for the IFR?
Oh boy, the IFR. They have a, noise folder, I think.
Service monitor. That's the word I'm looking for, service monitor. The piece of test equipment is called a service monitor. IFR is now a very popular brand name. Cushman used to be a very popular brand name. So this is a machine that has a pretty accurate, calibrated signal generator where you can dial in any frequency you want between the potentially 0 and 1,000 megacycles. It contains a receiver, which usually has a pan adapter display, so it's a kind of a spectrum analyzer. And a good service monitor allows you to make measurements on a repeater. You can set up the service monitor, so in this particular case, if you were testing this repeater, it would be putting out a weak signal at 146.25 megacycles at the input frequency of this repeater. The service monitor would simultaneously take the output of this repeater, which maybe is 50 watts, and the 50 watts would go into a dummy load, and a sample of that would be going into the receiver circuit of the service monitor, and it would measure how well the repeater is responding. So that kind of instrumentation, when you use it, allows you to really find out how good is your duplexing filter, how good is the low noise amplifier, how good is the receiver, how good is the transmitter, how good is the modulator, and so on. So signal to noise ratio of a receiver is a very valuable test when you're measuring receiver sensitivity. In order for the receiver to work well, it must have a low noise amplifier that's working correctly, a mixer that's working correctly, a local oscillator that is not squittering or drifting, an IF strip that's working, a demodulator that's working, an audio amplifier that's working, a power supply, a battery. You're doing an end-to-end test when you do that signal-to-noise ratio test in microvolts of input versus audio signal-to-noise ratio of what comes out. It's an end-to-end test of the hold-on radio. Essentially, everything has to work there except the paint on the front panel, so to speak, in order to pass that test. So if you were at Andy's testing bench, WA2CDL, who runs a testing clinic at almost every LIMOC meeting, at almost every LIMOC flea market. A flea market is coming up in exactly 2 weeks, February 24th, at Levittown Hall on a Sunday. You go there and you'll find a bench on top of the stage of the Levittown Hall. There you'll find Andy, WA2CDL. You walk over to Andy with your handy talkie, and you tell him, gee, I'd like it to have it tested. And Andy puts it on his service monitor, which is an IFR. He puts in a quarter of a microvolt. He measures the signal-to-noise ratio of output. He then keys your radio and measures the deviation when you talk into the microphone and say, hello. And he measures your deviation. He measures the PL tone. Is it on the right tone? 136.5 hertz. Is it the right PL tone deviation, the right amplitude of the PL tone? That service monitor gives him all of that information. And so once you learn how to do this jazz, you can become a radio maven. just like Andy, and you can make a whole lot of money. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Roger, this is K2KEY. Yeah, I'm just thinking of the one I have somewhere buried down. Poop made one for World War II. One of the first service, now they call it service monitor. The original name for it was Signal Noise Motor Monitor. That was Poop name. I started thinking of it. So they sort of simplified it. All right. Well, I guess you got to run off, Dick, so maybe we'll just cut it short and let you get some rest so you can get up nice and early in the morning and be sharp as a razor to take on the next challenge in this wonderful world we're involved here in electronics. K2RIW, the TechNet, K2KEY.
Yeah, what's kind of fascinating, Mel, is tomorrow morning I'm going to be interviewing a antenna engineer who was educated in China, and I believe the person is a female, and the person has a doctorate degree in electronics with a specialty for antenna engineering. Could be fascinating. 73, you all. I'm leaving, but Mel probably is going to stay for a while. He's probably going to go down his mailbag and be kind to each other. See you guys next week. K2KEY. Net control, you've got it, Mel.
Hey, Dick, take care. Nice talking to you as always, and we look forward, all of us, to hearing you continue this next week, and thank you very much for your input, as always. Okay, yeah, we can continue a little bit if I can find anybody that has any further information that they'd like to find. I got some more here and there, also on receivers and things and everything, so, anybody would like to make any comments or discuss anything in particular before we look at something else maybe of interest? This is K2KEY.
K2EKY from W2EWK, copy.
Go ahead. Go ahead, Eugene. Eugene, go ahead. I'm listening to you.
Now, can you hear me now? W2EWK.
Yes, I can copy you, Eugene. Go ahead. What can I help you with? Go ahead, please.
Okay, you're very, very scratchy. I'll talk to you later on. Have a fine night.
Okay, Eugene, thank you very much. Anybody else would like to join us? This is K2KEY. Okay, Roger. All right, let me just read over a couple more and see if anybody else would like to make any comments about it. All right, here, IMD. All right, here's another good question. This one comes from Kenny. Okay, Kenny, what's the problem with IMD? What exactly, how can you explain to me IMD? This is all new hands, and I can understand that it's a little bit complicated, like Dick says, when you first hear it, it's about such a sensitivity, signal-to-noise ratio. IMD is just another factor called intermodulation distortion. Now, what it actually is, to make it as simple as I can explain it, is actually it would be the blocking of the, or desensitizing of the receiver. It's usually IMD is caused by mixing of the receiver front end, you're mixing two signals. You got your wanted signal and your unwanted signal. And when they start to overlap, and let's say that the signal that is wanted is not as strong as the unwanted signal, the receiver has a tendency to what we know as start to pull over towards that signal that is predominating in signal strength if it's close enough. So, for instance, let me see. It would actually be referred to as the third order mixing product of two unwanted signals. Let me think if I can give a good example. If, for instance, we were on, say, let me think something out. If we were on, say, 20 meters, And we had one signal that we're listening to. This is our wanted signal, say at 14.060 down in CW band. And then another station comes on very strong at, say, 14.040, in other words, approximately 20 kilohertz spacing. If the frequencies would then mix possibly together and give you a false reading of a possibly an image at 14.08. So it would be that effect. It's actually called the formula for it, that you actually take these signals. Basically, how do I figure it? It's 2 times F1 minus F2. So if you use that type of formulation, you'll find out that the signal that you're listening to wants to shift over that 20 kilohertz. So that's basically IMD. It's called IMD, basically the central sensitizing of the receiver. Anybody have any questions on IMD? Over. Okay, Roger, that's the best way I can explain it. It's, I could say blocking or desensitizing the receiver. And again, it's caused by intermodulation, distortion, or mixing of two signals. Okay, here we go. Let's see, anything else that I can... I'll stop on waveguides here. I think I'll leave this for next week for Dick. Some very interesting comments about cross-guide coupling. So I think I'll leave that about next week for Dick. Another question here on IF. Oh, yeah, last week we discussed IF. So, what about this one? Okay, what can I do with this 10.7 megahertz FM broadcast receiver IF? Could I use that in an amateur radio equipment? Yeah, as long as it's 10.7. What do I do? But it's a much smaller transformer. Does it make a difference? No, you can make an adapter plate up. If you have one of the old type of IF, that's the 1-inch, what we used to refer to as the 1-inch transformer IF, and now you get these new ones that are used in the newer piece of equipment called the 0.75-inch. They're basically now on, of course, on metric. They're actually called 1.9-centimeter IF transformers. You can interchange them by getting a little adapter plate. I think the adapter plates were still available. I saw them in one of the catalogs. I believe DigiKey still sells the adapter plate that will make it possible to adapt the old-fashioned 1-inch IF can to the new version of the 0.75-inch transformer. So, and you can use the 10.7 megahertz IF that you find in the commercial broadcast receivers can be used in amateur radio receivers if they're required 10.7. And in fact, even if it's a 9 megahertz SFC type of transformer, you can also use that just to readjust it. It will work. Okay, this is K2KDY. Anybody have anything else?
Yeah, Dick, you did a very good job tonight. I hear you loud and clear this time. This time I'm on the beam, QSL, W2EWK.
Okay, Eugene, sounds good. Yeah, you got a nice clean signal now. Is there anything I can help you with, Eugene?
Not quite, but, oh yes, one thing I could use a little help with. I have some dry cells, and I want to charge those up. Should I use a regular 12-volt charger on say, 2 amps?
Okay, when you say dry cells, are these the rechargeable batteries, Eugene?
Yes, QSL.
Okay, the best way to charge the cell is to put a power supply, a variable power supply, across them and put a meter in series and charge them at approximately 10% of their rating. In other words, if it's a 1-amp battery, rechargeable battery, you charge it at 100 mil rate. So that way you don't cook it, yet you will charge it at a sufficient rate to bring it up, Eugene. The best way, I could say, put a variable power supply on it that you can adjust. Keep an eye on it that, you know, the current doesn't start to creep up as the battery starts to heat up, Eugene, over.
Okay, very good. Yeah, that's what we're going to do. So, as I took it too, go nice and slowly onto the battery to become fully charged. Yes, Dick, I really enjoy your QSO, you know, your acknowledgement and that stuff, and, you know, it really helps. Oh, one more thing. On 60 meters, if I make a vertical, how high should I make, you know, the antenna? How high should I go? Because if I use a vertical, it's like on 60 meters, it's 45 feet on each side. QSL?
Roger, this is K2KUY. Okay, as far as operating, you know, like bands like very close to 75 meters, 60 meter band, 80 meter band, and using an antenna on it to 60 meters, a dipole at, well, not lower than a quarter wavelength above ground is usually a decent antenna. If you're looking to use a vertical, well, the vertical is going to require, you know, a number of radios. It's going to become a perfect project because the antenna itself, I could say, is going to be that height that, you know, you have to put down a number of radios. So a simpler antenna just to get you on 60 meters, what I've found many people get a very good result with just a straightforward dipole, Eugene, over.
Okay, that's how I took it too. It's not practical to make a ground plane. It's not going to be too long. Okay, 73 to you, and 3W2EWK, be clear. Thank you.
Hey, yeah, don't get me wrong, Eugene. On 80 meters, one. Somewhat of a, say, a cloud warm-up, but what I want to do, I only want to work, you know, more or less within a few hundred mile radius to my friends I get on with on 75 meters. But for DXing, I do use a vertical antenna on 80 meters on the CW portion, but it's a big antenna. It's 66 feet tall, and it requires, it's got 100 radials buried, so that's what is really, to get an effective radiator, a vertical radiator on those bands does take, if you really want a good effective radiator, this is what it takes. But that's the low band DX. If you just want to get on 60 meters, a dipole is the simplest, cheapest, quickest, and this will do the job by all. Okay, this is KTY. Anything else?
Okay, thank you. And we have our friend in there too, right by 101. Okay, W2EWK clear.
Okay, roger. Thank you very much, Eugene. So, anybody else have anything else that they'd like to discuss? This is K2KUY.
WS2N, Mel?
Okay, go ahead, Paul. Put in some good words of wisdom.
No, I don't have any. You mentioned 75 meters. I tried that Thursday night, and I didn't hear George in there. So I gave it a shot Thursday. I couldn't get to the radio at night that late during the previous week. But I gave it a shot on Thursday. I'll try again maybe tomorrow.
Roger. Yeah, we'll be getting together usually Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. We've got a nice group going because George explained at the club meeting to a few of the other people that get on 75. We dragged them. They were all over the band, different places. So we got them all dragged to 3820 now, 3.820 around 11:30 at night. So got George, and there's a Solitary, K3HKR. You'll most likely hear him. He's got quite a setup. And Jim also, K3FZF. And he's a regular. And a few others that K6TS that moved to Pennsylvania. No, he's down now. He moved to Maryland. Paul, another Paul. Who else is joining us on there now? I think there's one or two others. So we got a nice group there, including WB3FRY George. So they're all involved in all kinds of projects, antenna projects and all. So tomorrow night we'll be there at 11:30 at night. Also, if you want to hang on there a little bit, around 11:30. Which goes on and on. I was on Friday night, almost 3 o'clock in the morning. I had a lot of callers and started talking about these loop antennas. It seems like it attracts a lot of people onto the frequency. And, you know, we start talking about receiving loops and things like that. It seems to be a very fascinating subject. And I see even in QST, we're seeing more and more different loop antennas recently. Now I see one of the newest issue, a guy adding a loop antenna on to a beat. WS2X, K2KEY.
Well, yeah, it's different, so anything different is going to, everybody's ears are going to go up. Sounds good. Okay, I picked the wrong night. I picked Thursday. Thursday is easy for me because I'm on late on a 2-meter simplex net. There's a net in Connecticut, 145.505, and been on that for years. So by the time that goes off, now it's, you know, I'm still in the radio, so I just am able to click over. But okay, Wednesday's better. We'll try that. Monday and Wednesday and Friday. We'll give that a shot. So, yeah, sounds good. Sounds like you got a bigger group now that you moved up frequency. Very good. I'll let you continue on, Mel. I really don't have anything else. And let's see. I didn't hear anybody else in there. So back to you there, Mel. K2KYWS.
Okay, very good, Paul. Yeah, in fact, George even asked you a couple of times if I hear you, because I guess you two have that the hobby of also trains. Model train comments. Okay, anybody else would like to ask any questions or add anything to any of the above? This is K2KEY. I'm listening. Okay, I guess that's it. All right, covered a lot of subjects tonight, and got a few more here on, basically on antenna geometry and things of that sort. So I'll leave that for next week, because I think that Dick would love to get in on this, and I'm sure his input is very important. I know his specialty is antenna, and especially UHF, VHF, you know, microwave antenna, so he's more of, as they say, the expert on it, the maven on it, than I am. I'm just passing, you know, interest on things that fascinate me, and I have, you know, not studied them in depth like Dick. All right, with that, I'll say it to everybody. Thank you very much for joining us here on the TechNet, and we'll look forward to talking to everybody again next week. Take care. Have a nice week. Try to stay warm. I think we're going to have some real cool weather the next 24 hours especially. So take care. Be careful, especially in the cold weather. And, you know, if you have any elderly people in your family, neighbors and all, good thing to check on them, just like you do when we have these heat waves, to make sure that they're, you know, warm in this time of year and cool in the middle of the heat wave in the summertime. So, you know, it's just good to be a good neighbor, good relative or whatever, you know, just a good human being. 73 is all. This is K2KEY.